This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Coming up, we've got all the news and views from Manchester City's week. It's your club, and this is your show.
Another week and more ridiculous numbers posted by Erling Haaland as Manchester City make it three wins from their first three matches. Top of the table going into the international break and at a time when we and Pep Guardiola all expected the team to be a little bit underprepared for the new season. On today's Blue Moon podcast, we'll take a look back over the win against West Ham with a particular focus on the big Norwegian powerhouse at the top end of the pitch. But we'll also reserve some time to take a look at the other key performers. Jack Grealish was back in the team with the outside noise suggesting he needs a good season, while Rico Lewis again put in a display that demonstrated experience far beyond his years. And with Haaland's latest triple, City are now the team in the Premier League with the most hat-tricks. What more excuse do we need to get a load of Berts together to talk about our favourite ones? That's coming up later on too. I'm David Mooney. Alongside me today, I've got two City fans. I've got Chris Higginbottom.
Hello there.
And from the Hits 21 podcast, Rob Wilson.
Hi, David. Hi.
So we're going to start with the West Ham game in a second. But Chris, City's 99 away kit got announced in this week. Oasis are back. What else from the 90s would you like to bring back here?
Well, with reference to Oasis, perhaps more reasonable pricing structures would be good. my hair. I had a nice mop in the 90s.
I can't imagine you with hair. I can't imagine you with hair, you know. It's funny. I imagine you've been bald your entire life.
How dare you?
Is that a bad thing to say?
Yeah, it's pretty offensive, to be honest. But luckily I've got thick skin, even on the top of my head due to all the sun damage. But no, that's fine. I somehow looked even cooler, David, with hair. I know that's hard to believe. Yeah. Lynx Java, what a fragrance. That would be good. Going through the first team songs before kickoff when they were warming up on the pitch, that should be brought back. Do you remember that?
What I
think. Peter Kay, who remembers?
You mean the fans singing songs before kickoff?
Or, yeah. Basically, the Kippax would go through a rendition of like the full. God, I was going to say roster then. That's what America's done to us. The full, like,
the
team
book.
That were playing that day, or whoever's on the pitch would get a song sung about them, unless they were Gary Megson or something. But, you know, anyone who had a song would get it sung prior to kickoff, and they'd turn and acknowledge and raise their hands and give us a round of applause back to the crowd. And it was just a nice bit of to and fro and a bit of, you know, a nice little frisson, a bit of a relationship establisher between the crowd and the fans. I have actually jotted a couple of other things down, so I'll rattle through them that's enough, shut up.
I love how seriously you take this opening question, that you sit there and you make notes about it, and it's just like, it's literally just a thing to get us warmed up.
Well, I'm sorry for being thorough and trying to lend myself an air of professionalism for a change, but
we don't do professionalism,
you know,
anyway,
won't do it again. But biodiversity, David, that's what I'd like to see more of that we had in the 90s, more insects. Furthermore, people who have those fly traps, you know, where it's like a lure, something sweet in a plastic container that lures flies into their ultimate doom. That is linked to the lack of biodiversity. People who do that, and I'm sorry if I'm offending anyone present today, but subhuman scum. Basically, you are wiping out a base level of, you know, the ecosystem and the biodiversity on which all life depends. And if you do really need one of those things to get rid of all the flies that are collecting around your house, maybe you fucking stink. Maybe you're the problem.
Okay, well, I wasn't expecting that was where we were going to go with this. Rob, please bring some sanity back to proceedings. And, you're a little bit younger than us. So, what from the 90s would you like to bring back? Is there anything you remember from the 90s that you think actually would do really well in the 2020s?
Being able to sit in the departures bit of Manchester Airport with my dad and watching the planes take off and land of a Sunday morning or a Saturday morning when you could go right up to that bit, which is now obviously all closed off with security. And the other thing I miss is actually just being unavailable as well. People being unavailable. Yeah, that's something I do miss.
Well, yeah, always connected, aren't we? That's the problem with the 2020s. But you know,
pre-tech anonymity.
Yeah, exactly that. Okay, we've rambled on for far too long about the olden days. Let's bring in some chat about West Ham. I'm going to start with Erling Haaland because I mean, ultimately, Chris, a ridiculous man with ridiculous performances and ridiculous numbers at this stage. 11 hat tricks in 102 games for City. That's a hat-trick every 9.2 games. The start of this season, two more already. He means business, doesn't he?
He does. I mean, we all thought Aguero was a bit mental with his hat-trick ratio. I used to say he's got a hat-trick ball pool at his house, but Haaland's his Olympic size. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
I don't know where he puts them all. I noticed someone, you know, when they all have to sign it, don't they, the team on the day, and it gets, you know, might get auctioned or just put in a glass case somewhere under the stadium, I don't know, but someone had written, "I am sick of signing these match balls."
I think it's Grealish. Someone else I think had it just was written, Grealish, yeah.
I think it might have been, and someone had just gone with, and it seemed to be by the same hand, just a good old-fashioned Anglo-Saxon fuck off.
Yeah.
Such as their frustration at having to continually sign the match balls. Sorry, I've sworn twice, we've only been on about 10 minutes. So
it's all right.
For our younger listeners.
I've given apart. Up. I've given up the days of not marking each episode explicit. I mean, literally everybody we have on now. This is what City drives you to, swearing left, right and centre. Rob, he's averaging more than a goal every Premier League game for City since he arrived. And this season, no team has scored more than him. It's just ridiculous, these numbers. The fact that that we can keep pulling out these stats, it's getting mad now.
And he looks sharp again too, which was the main thing for me watching these sort of like last two or three games, and especially against West Ham, because his numbers last season were still incredible, but they had obviously dropped a little bit from the treble winning season. And his performances sometimes did look at his movement felt a bit, you know, there was that theory going around sort of in some quarters last season that like he'd grown an extra inch and his body hadn't quite got used to being that extra inch away from the ball and stuff.
What was that? So, I hadn't seen that.
I think it was just, yeah, it was just people looking for reasons as to why, you know, physically it looked like his movements didn't look like they were entirely pain-free, and now we know that.
Sorry, I've just had the image of, you know when a baby elephant doesn't know how to control its legs or trunk because it's too long and it's like a bit ungangly. I just imagine that at the top end of the pitch for City.
So he's just not quite hitting volleys because his brain thinks his limbs are slightly shorter than they are.
Yeah.
I think it was just like people looking for any kind of reason as to why the Haaland that we knew from the treble winning season wasn't quite there last season, but his stats have never really been a problem for me. You know, it was always wanting him to at least look happy on the pitch, if you know what I mean. I feel like it felt that way in the first sort of few months of his City season. And then after, do you know that it was a dead rubber game in the Champions League against Dortmund, in Dortmund, and he went off at half-time with that ankle injury. And it feels like since then, he's always kind of been playing with a degree of pain in one way or another. And then I watched that treble documentary and there's that shot of his feet at one point, and he looks like a ballet dancer because he gets stood on so much and he gets, you know, studs in his feet all the time. And it feels like after a few months away from that, and after a few months of just not playing football and not doing anything, he's even said, you know, I needed to let my body rest. And it feels like he just looks happier and sharper. His ability in front of goals never, you know, he's maybe his confidence went in little bits of last season with missing some big chances, but it just feels like his body, when he's striking the ball to put it in the net, it feels like his body's back in a comfortable position, like he's seen it beforehand, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. And Chris,
he looks a bit looser and freer, doesn't he? He's like, there's a lot to be said for a footballer being allowed not to play football.
Yeah. And I mean, the other side of this, Chris, as well, is like, even stats wise, as Rob mentioned there, like he's improved so far. It's only three games. It's a small sample size, but he's improved on every metric from his previous two seasons so far. His big chance conversion rate is better. His conversion rate is better. His accuracy is better. He's had 14 shots in total this season. He's scored half of them and 10 of them have been on target. So he's only like, of all of his shots this season, only four have been off target. He's had seven goals. Like that's a mad proportion so far.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's obviously had a software update. he's just moves from strength to strength. Even his link-up play, which I've always been quite defensive about because people would say that his link-up play isn't very good. And I was like, oh, I think it's pretty good. But you can see visibly that that has, you know, improved. And he's not afraid to put a shift in defensively either. So him closing down that attack down the left wing at West Ham, he must have run 80 yards just to shut that down. And yeah, his teammates will appreciate that as well as the fans.
The closing down thing as well, Rob. I mean, Guardiola picked up on that. I think it was over pre-season he was kind of hinting that he wanted Haaland to be doing more. And then you saw like what he's been doing in the last few weeks. As Chris says, he's been closing down. He's been pressing. He's been doing all that sort of stuff that Guardiola wants from a forward. And it's kind of like you think of how when Haaland was first here, he was like, yeah, we just leave him up there, let him score goals. It's almost like Guardiola's now trying to level him up as well.
Yeah, and I think as well that Haaland's physically capable of doing that now. It feels like maybe at points last season, I don't know if it was under instruction from Pep or if it was just something Haaland was doing himself, but it's not like he was hiding in games or anything like that. But I do think that his involvement off the ball was perhaps minimized by the fact that he was trying to put himself in a, you know, physically in a position where he could contribute when he actually was in possession and City were on the attack. I think, you know, it's something that's actually maybe crept into his games. You know, that Forest game away last season.
Yeah.
And that was the first time I'd seen him in a little while, and he came on and he was like, right, I'm ready. I'm into every aspect of this. And that felt great. You know, obviously just with the win, but like a happy Haaland means a happy City. And it feels like since, because he got, is it 4 against Wolves shortly after that as well? And it felt like he was getting back into his groove. And I feel like if we'd have been in the latter stages of the Champions League, by the time he, you know, sort of came from that Forest sub appearance, I think, you know, could have been looking at another, you know, another final at least if we'd have still been in it. And if he was still sort of happy and ready to come back. But I think since then and through pre-season and stuff, even the type of goals he's scoring, that one against Chelsea where he has to be simultaneously strong and skillful and nimble and then have the alertness to just lift it over Sanchez and also remember that bit of information he stored about Sanchez staying on his line. It just feels like it's all functioning very well for him at the moment, and I hope it continues.
Yeah.
I won't say that it definitely will, because, like, you know, anything can happen.
Yeah, things happen.
It feels like if he carries on in this vein of form, he looks like he feels good, yeah, which is important.
It's almost been like a build up to this point. It's frustrating the international breaks here, if anything, Chris, because it feels like there's like he's built up to the West Ham performance, because it felt like West Ham was his most involved display this season, kind of starting with Chelsea and kind of the post match interview where he talks about not really getting too involved because everybody else was doing it around him, through the Ipswich game where he gets a hat trick, and then into the West Ham game where he's kind of coming in, dropping deep, helping with the link up, and feeling the most involved he's felt for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely hate the international break after 3 games. It just seems idiotic. But yeah, if you're on a really good run, it's bad. If you're Everton, maybe you're
thankful for it.
Glad of it. Yeah, thank God we needed that break. It's been awful. But yeah, it really does put a spoke in the wheels in terms of momentum. But hopefully, Haaland. I mean, do we know who Norway have got? Have they got a friendly or?
I mean, he'll probably play, like, they'll probably play 2 games. But if they've got 2 games, he'll probably play 2 games. This is the sort of thing I should have checked. So I'm just going to waffle on.
Yeah, me too, to be fair.
I Google Norway fixtures and then we'll find out. So they play Kazakhstan on Friday and then they play Austria on Monday.
Right. I mean, you'd hope and expect that he'd get through the Kazakhstan game without much exertion, but Austria might be tricky. I don't know if it's a qualifier or just a friendly, but yeah, not just the momentum, is it, that you lose? It's the dread of injury to your players when everything's going so well. But you know, these things are beyond our control. So unlike the games we watch as a fan, where your investment obviously has some kind of influence,
we're all in full control of those. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, not even in control of my own emotions, never mind anything else. But yeah, I mean, you'd like to think that he'll continue that momentum with his country, and a couple of easier games in the Prem might even do him and the rest of the team a world of good.
Yeah, I like the way you've described Brentford at home as an easier game, because they've traditionally never caused us problems at the Etihad. But there we go. That's a next week's show problem.
No, no. I mean the easier game, perhaps an easier run of games in the international break.
Oh, I see. Sorry.
Do as good. Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. No disrespect to Brentford, who I am genuinely cacking myself about.
Same.
Let's talk about the wingers, Rob, because Grealish was given a start for the West Ham game with Savinho injured. He needs a season this season. What did you make of him?
Do you know, David? I've been on the show like once every sort of like 5 years, and since we've signed Grealish and since he's become like part of the team, I have hoped and prayed that when I returned and came back on, I would get a chance to get on my soapbox about Grealish, and then he delivers that kind of performance at the weekend. I will kind of caveat it by saying that he's clearly not fully fit yet, because like the last 5 or 10 minutes that he spent on the pitch, I genuinely thought he was injured and he was probably just blowing out his arse because he'd not really played that much football recently. But the rest of his performance, I think, kind of typifies everything that he brings to us and everything that I feel like I need to bang my head against the wall about. I know his reputation with fans, like City fans, is generally better these days, but I've always kind of like, he's always been one of my absolute favourites ever since he turned up. I know that like people want more of him in front of goal in terms of contributing goals and assists and stuff. But I think like I saw somebody on Twitter referring to him as a facilitator, which I really enjoy. And I know that sounds like, you know, kind of nonsense language to mask the fact that like he doesn't contribute enough goals and stuff. But like, do you know the Champions League away game against Liverpool in 2018 where we got beat 3-0 and Pep started Gundogan on the right? I think Grealish has always been the logical extension of that, where Pep clearly wants somebody in the final third whose first thought is to control the pace of the game and slow the ball and allow players to get back into position while still moving the team forward and occupying defenders. He does all of this stuff. And the one thing that was maybe missing from the West Ham performance, I thought, from him, just because of fitness, was just his work rate wasn't quite as high as it's been. I think if you watch back the run-up to the treble, so like the last sort of 8 to 10 games in all competitions, his work rate is astounding. Like, genuinely really astounding. His stamina is on the levels of Bernardo Silva, for me, for someone who can just run and run and run and run and run for 90 minutes when he's had a full run of games. And I think, like, but apart from that, I think that he controls the rest of the team, and the rest of the team look to him for control. Whenever they give him the ball, they know that he's going to buy us 2 or 3 seconds to get everybody in position for where they need to be. This is something that I think Pep really prioritizes, that it's not, you know, it's like, don't pass the ball to the player. You pass the ball to the position and the player will already be there, sort of thing. And you can see it in the way that we move. That's
it's almost like a set piece, isn't it, giving it Grealish?
It is. When he gets the ball out there, it's like everything stops dead for a second and everybody reorganizes themselves while the defenders are being pulled towards him. You saw it actually when Haaland got his second goal, where it's Grealish who picks the ball up and kind of starts the recycle of the move, where he picks the ball up and there's about 3 West Ham players in front of him, nicks past one of them and then plays it across the penalty area. And from then on, any of Lewis, Kovacic or Haaland can take a shot. It's just that we get it to Haaland because he's the most reliable. Mm. He does that all the time. He manages to carry the ball 30 yards without actually sort of taking anybody on, but he drags 3 players away from other positions. It's something that I think literally every City player that has ever been interviewed about, like, oh, what does Grealish bring to the team? They all say, well, he creates space for literally everybody else. And we always look at our most composed when he's out there. The other, you know, when David Silva voted Gareth Barry as his player of the year in 2012.
Another facilitator.
That's how I feel.
Yeah,
that's how I feel about Grealish. It's just that he plays in a slightly more advanced position, so people expect more of him. And I think, yeah, the chance that he kind of hit into the defender's legs and went wide, those are the ones that in an ideal world, I think he would be scoring. And I think if those were put in, he'd be sort of undroppable.
Yeah, I think the thing with Grealish, Chris, is I guess we'd be sitting here talking about an ideal Grealish performance if that chance that Rob mentions where he's one-on-one and ends up hitting it into the defender's legs goes in, or if the one where straight after De Bruyne hits the post and it bounces out to him, if Grealish then puts that into the corner of the net like he's trying to. That's the difference, isn't it? That's the tipping point, I guess, for the criticism.
Yeah, I mean, there's those little moments. It's like Foden from England, you know, width of a post a couple of times, and he's had a good tournament. with Grealish, I think he's hampered in terms of criticism by the player he used to be at Villa still. People's, why isn't he just getting the ball and bombing at the box? You know what I mean? It's like, well, because he's in a different system. He's developing as a player. He knows his role. Exactly, yeah. And like I was saying when Rob was speaking, it's like, it's almost like a set piece. When he gets the ball, everyone's like, right, Grealish has got it there. You do that. We know, you know, they all know their little roles, their little runs to make, how to drag the play to their favour, you know, drag the defenders to the, to our attacks advantage when in that situation. Similar to Haaland, where, you know, people talk about his lack of touches. And it's like, well, no matter where he is, there's twice as many people dragged toward, over towards him as there would be for practically any other player. And yeah, it's players with that sort of stature and that sort of influence, both on the pitch at the same time. I mean, it really does make a difference, sets the tempo, draws more players to him, allows us to do things that we kind of can do in our sleep now because Pep's got, you know, a little in-play routines down to an absolute T and they all understand their roles. Absolutely delighted to see him back. He's not like, again, as Rob alluded to, he's not quite at the intensity he was in the treble season, but certainly compared to that, should we call it the hangover season, he's definitely improved on that and heading towards the Jack Grealish that we need performing on that level.
Yeah, let's touch on Rico Lewis as well, Chris, because, I mean, Guardiola said he's merited play in these last few weeks. How long can that carry on? Because there's going to come a point where, like, he might merit it as he might keep putting in these performances and merit it, but City are playing every 3 days and he can't play every single game.
No, and Kyle Walker will start throwing his weight around as well, I think. But he's totally there on merit. I've always said one of his greatest attributes is knowing when to fall over and get the ball, you know, just stop play. Mm. He's the best since Didi Haman at that for me. But his actual football play, you know, just sounds really rubbish. You know his football play? Have you seen that? But his actual, you know, he's got such a diverse repertoire. Like, he can do everything. He can play multiple positions. He's good in tight spaces. He reads the game well defensively. He's quick enough. He's strong in the tackle. He's got an eye for a pass. He can score goals. He'll be gutted not to have scored. I think he's missed two big chances recently, and I'm sure he'll bury the next one that comes his way. But he's literally, he's just a very good all-round footballer, and we're lucky to have him, and a local lad to boot. So love him to bits. Hopefully he'll stay at the club for a long time.
Yeah, Rob, it's interesting that normally when you think about players that get a free role, you always think about players that are playing on the wing or are playing a number eight role, and it's kind of like the manager going, well, you can kind of go in there and kind of roam free. It's not often you give that to a right back. So the fact that he's getting that from Guardiola and he's popping up in the pockets, it's kind of suggesting he's doing quite well.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think Pep's always seen something in him ever since he was kind of dropped in midway through that season. It's rare that Pep ever kind of does that to someone under 20, you know, just kind of, you have a run of games now. Like, you know, it's normally an appearance here, an appearance there. Gradually the numbers go up and they become more of a regular fixture, kind of like Foden. It feels like even the defensive side of his game's coming on, you know, especially against Chelsea. I thought he was my man of the match against Chelsea in the first game of the season. I thought the way that he asserts himself as someone who has maybe some physical disadvantages compared to other players on the pitch, the way that he asserts himself, and it means he now buys himself that time, and his intelligence now can really show. I think his use of the ball has always been, like, you know, way beyond his years. I think, like, his ability to read the pitch and find himself in space, he's never behind a player. You know, he's always available for a pass and that sort of thing. And now it feels like the two have come together, and Walker's still there, and I still love Walker, despite, you know, the fact that he's probably slowing down a bit as he enters his mid-30s. But all over the squad, I feel like we have this same amazing problem for Pep to solve, really, which is that, like, when you're choosing between Lewis and Walker, or Grealish and Savinho, or Doku, or whatever, or even in midfield, where, like, you know, Gundogan and Kovacic, and it just feels like we have so many options this season. So many options to do different things in different games, and the players seem to already have an understanding of that they might be specifically required for certain games. And so having Lewis and Walker be the two battling it out for right back I'm looking forward to this season a lot. I feel good vibes about this season. Whether we win a trophy or not, I think that just watching us is going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, there's a lot of games as well, so I don't think people should get too hung up on players not playing in particular games, because there is going to be a lot of games this season.
You can listen to the show ad-free by joining our Patreon, patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Couple of other bits to finish the first part of the show, Rob. Let's start with De Bruyne. He's looking fitter than at any point last season. Nice continued recovery from his injury and kind of nice start to the season for him.
He is. I started to worry about him a little bit last season towards the end, because it felt like, you know how two or three times over sort of like the last 3 or 4 years, he's sort of had a run of form where you think, oh, is this the downturn? Is this kind of how it's going to be now? And then he fights back. And he always seems to do this, but one time or another, I think, you know, that won't be the case. But it feels like he's having another, you know, bit of a fight back. But I think...
Trying to be too accurate with that shot that hit the post?
Maybe. Only he will know, I guess. But it was so nice to see him put together the kind of performance where afterwards, even opposition fans were looking at his compilation from the West Ham game and going, well, he didn't score or make an assist, but wow, like the things he creates and the things that he does are so unique to him. I think that corner routine that he played where he ended up with a shot and Areola made that excellent save to tip it over the bar. As soon as that happened, I was trying to think of literally any other player in the Premier League who would even try that and then pull it off like that to force in the keeper. It's just, he has such beautiful way of striking that ball. Everything is so aesthetically amazing, and the fact that he's still producing this and still doing this after so many opportunities, after so many periods where you think, oh, maybe that injury is the one that's too far, or that run of form is the one that, you know, is the one that he won't recover from, and to still produce performances like that again, I love the vibes of this team at the moment. I think there are so many great vibes, and I think like bringing Gundogan back will be a big help to De Bruyne this season.
Chris, to finish, Edison with a very big save at the end. Not important for the result, but very important for the charity bet, because it meant that we won with the 3-1. Important for him as well, I guess, because he's obviously had a bit of criticism about his saving ability. And then it's nice every now and then that he pops one of these out to go, actually, you know what? I can save some shit.
Yeah, I mean, it was a nice height, wasn't it?
Don't be doing this to me, mate.
Oh no, you're just having a go at Kevin De Bruyne for trying to be too accurate. You know what pisses me off about De Bruyne? He always tries to just put it right in the corner, doesn't he? Wanker. Do you think he is?
Yeah, but I'm not a member of the attacking midfielders union, am I? I'm a member of the goalkeeping union. Here you are with the nice height stuff. No, I'm not having that.
Well, you know, where he draws criticism is that if someone gets through one-on-one, you expect it to go in. Now, I'd be the first person to say that's because, you know, that's just the way it is, and we don't get many of those, and yeah, it brings more to the team. And I don't appreciate the criticism of him, but yeah, it was quite a nice height. I mean, he's not had to dive low or anything like that. It's not going in the corner. It's on target. He's tipped it onto the post. Great for the confidence. But even his reaction, he wasn't like, you know, there was no fist bump or overexertion, or, you know, it was just a case of, that's what I do. Yeah, let's get on with defending the corner.
I don't think he ever reacts like that.
Just standard.
Doesn't ever react.
Well,
like
no,
that.
But well, maybe only on social media, or if he's leaving that to his wife.
Fair enough. I'm not having that. It's a brilliant save. So there we are. And my say on it is more important than yours, because I'm a goalkeeper. There we go. We're going to talk more about hat-tricks now. Erling Haaland's second hat-trick of the season means that no club has scored more hat-tricks in the Premier League than City. It's International Week, and that means there's space in the show for me to sound the Bert alarm and gather the troops to reminisce about our favourite hat-tricks of City's 43. You'll hear from Dom Farrell and KC shortly, but we start with Dan Burke's memories of the first hat-trick City scored in the Premier League, as Paolo Wanchope scored 3 against Sunderland at Main Road.
I was on holiday in North Wales, and I remember being sat in my dad's car listening to it on the radio, and we'd had a crap start to that season, hadn't we, beaten at Charlton away after coming up.
What a start that was.
Yeah, it really took the wind out of our sails day one, didn't it, basically. Then we play Sunderland at home in the second game, and One Shot gets the hat trick, obviously. And I remember thinking, oh man, maybe there's something to come from this season. Maybe we've got something to look forward to. And you know, it didn't turn out to be the case. But that was such a great summer, wasn't it? Signing like Weah, One Shot, Haaland, etc. Alfie Haaland, that is, of course. You know, I remember listening to a phone in on GMR that summer, and some City fan being on going, we're going to win the league. This team we've got, it's going to be fantastic. And like I said, yeah, the bubble burst pretty quickly against Charlton, and then we had this this great one against Sunderland, and that was pretty much as good as the season got, to be honest.
Which signing were you most excited about that summer? Because I remember being most excited about One Shot, whereas a load of people seem to be, obviously, you know, with Weah coming along, most people were excited about him.
My mind was blown by George Weah signing, to be honest with you. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
Because I think he might, because obviously, like, you know, winning World Player of the Year in 95 and that incredible run goal. But in my head, I just associated One Shot with that amazing goal for Derby against United. Mm. So, yeah, I was really excited for him.
Yeah, none of his three in that game, Dom, were like they were all kind of awkward and gangly, weren't they? That just kind of summed him up. A hat trick of One Shot goals is a joy to behold.
Yeah, and I think the like I say, him and Weah that night were just spectacular together. I mean, I was there, and it just felt like, I mean, I only started going to Main Road in like 1993, but it felt like one of the last like properly great joyful games at Main Road, like particularly like after like the promotions, the back-to-back getting there, like that night, like I said, as Dan alluded to, that they'd got turned over properly at Charlton, and also, but also playing the first game after you've gone up against the team you played the year before anyway, there's so much about that Charlton game which was unsatisfactory, but yeah, that whole night was brilliant. There's something about early season, like the team's coming out in the floodlights and it's still a bit light, and that's always a great atmosphere for a game anyway.
They've done away with that midweek game in the first week, and it's not the same, is it?
That was just great. And that, also, like Joe Royal talks about cityitis, and like that game itself was, in a nutshell, because they were brilliant first half, deservedly led 2-0. And then out of nowhere, Sunderland are back in it. Brilliant finish by Kevin Phillips, and Niall Quinn scored, who was like my first City hero, so he was involved. And you think, oh, here we go. But then they sort of came again. And yeah, it was... Weah definitely got a couple of assists, didn't he? Mm. And yeah, the way they linked up was great. But yeah, those goals in the second half where they like One Shot like galloping towards the Platt Lane end were just brilliant. And also, I mean, given, you know, the reason we're talking about hat-tricks, a nice topical... score of the other goal there, wasn't it? Of course, with it being Alfie Haaland sliding one at the back post.
Yeah. Before we get to Haaland, though, we bring it kicking and screaming into the modern era with Aguero, because he's the City player with the most hat-tricks, KC. Are there any that stand out for you? Any favourite Aguero hat-tricks?
Well, the record-breaking one at Aston Villa was nice, you know, because obviously the result was 6-1, which I'm always fond of.
Yes, yeah.
But probably my favourite was the one against Chelsea, where I think he managed to score a screamer, yet also missed from like less than half a yard, which was just an incredible hat trick. But even when he did one against Spurs, he managed to miss a penalty for a fourth as well, didn't he?
Yeah.
So it just seemed to be there was some days, obviously like scoring five against Newcastle, there just seemed to be some days where he just looked like he was always in the perfect position to just get a few. And you could kind of tell with Aguero, the atmosphere was in the air before it even kind of started. Like, I think against Wigan, you just felt like he was going to get a few. Like, you know, before the game even started, the way he was moving off the ball, and you just thought, oh, he's on form here, he's gonna help himself.
Yeah. Now, when you said Chelsea, I thought you meant initially the one at Stamford Bridge. That's one I remember really, strangely, quite fondly, Dan, even though it was in that fluorescent yellow kit and everything. And in a bad season as well. It was like a really nice game in the middle of a bad season.
It was a ghost green kit, let's have it right.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Fluorescent Sami Nasri as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, with his blonde hair. Yeah, you read my mind there, because I was going to say that is that's like the archetypal Sergio Aguero hat trick. I think really the goals that he scored in that game, it was just proper like bagsman, like steel eyed, assassin type finishes every single one, weren't they? Like, it was on Twitter recently, actually, because you know, we played Chelsea recently, and they showed it again. I was watching it. I was going, bloody hell! Like, you kind of forget what an incredible striker he was. You know, even when you're watching Haaland these days, I don't think Haaland's quite as good a finisher as Aguero was, and quite as lethal at just sort of hitting the bottom corners and you know, those kind of goals where it just like takes a bounce just before it goes over the line, like a low finish, that he was so good at that. So yeah, I think of that one as well. And the other one against Chelsea when we beat them, was it 6-0, 6-1?
Yeah.
And he scored a hat-trick and missed an open net.
The thing about so many of Aguero's goals, though, was and I think what people do forget, you know, speaking, Dan, where you said about people forgetting how good he was, he made so many of his own goals, didn't he? Mm. Out of absolutely nothing, where he just nip it past the last man. And obviously, you know, the classic Aguero, you know, you think about is just smashing it in at the near post, isn't it? But yeah, he's just an incredible finisher. But it was just the amount of goals, when you do go back and watch, that he actually made for himself. Because I think a lot of people just have in the red that David Silva just put everything on the plate for him.
Yeah, easily done, though, in fairness. David Silva was pretty good at doing that.
yeah, fair.
Dom, another one I think of is Watford at Vicarage Road, when it was the third one where he dribbled past everybody and they almost cleared it off the line. There's something pleasing about a goal that goes in when the opposition haven't quite got it off the line. Any others stand out for you?
I also like goals like that Watford one where like you end up with men in the net with the ball as well, which is like properly proper Keystone Cops type thing. One that stands out to me is the Newcastle 5 goal one, for a particular reason that I was working at Perform News Agency at the time, and we'd have a lot of lads in the office for the 3 p.m. games. We used to have the Brew game, which very simply was, if your team was playing in a 3 o'clock, you would have your team, otherwise you'd be assigned one. And whoever's team in the Brew game conceded first in the 3 o'clocks had to go and make the half-time brews.
Excellent policy.
That day, City lost me the Brew game because Newcastle went ahead. And he had like a flurry of goals at the start of the second half. So I was, and it was a big brew round that day. So I was like just like ferrying cups of tea out of the kitchen. And then every time I came out with like 3 or 4 more brews, like, oh, he's gone and scored again, hasn't he? Yeah. I was like, you know, it's like tea getting spilled everywhere as Aguero was just rinsing through Newcastle. So that's quite a funny one. But I'd echo what the lad said about, like, there's something so pleasing about that Aguero finish, like just the way he'd hit a ball like that. Like the short backlift finish, it feels like very like you get a few like Argentinian strikers. I mean, I guess Tevez was a bit like that. How it's like no backlift, but it's almost like they're punching the ball with their foot. I mean, maybe the most famous finish of his like that was a certain one against Queen's Park Rangers. But yeah, they were aesthetically brilliant to watch. Like his best goals, like the Chelsea one Dan was talking about. They're just such sweet strikes. It's he wasn't bad, was he?
I watched that Newcastle one in a hostel in Peru when I was travelling with a Geordie who was giving it large when they went 1-0 up and wasn't giving it so large at the end.
Did you have to make him a cup of mate at half time?
Well, I think I've probably told this before, but I watched that obviously in the stadium, but with a Geordie mate who just got more and more pissed the more that we were dominating the game. And we nicked, you know, those wooden forks from the food stall on the concourse. Mm. And there was a guy stood in front of us with like an army-style jacket that had lapels on it. And just all during the second half, we were just like playing a game of buckaroo by just putting wooden forks onto his jacket and in his hood and everything. So yeah, that was how I enjoyed the 5-0 Newcastle.
Still haven't forgiven Pellegrini for taking him off either.
Oh, what an idiot.
I will stand by this because Pellegrini said afterwards, and Aguero did say afterwards and confirmed it as well, he was injured. So I know there's always the chance of a double hat trick, but like, he was injured.
A load of bollocks, Mooney. Contrarian bastard.
Aguero, it's a good way into this because Aguero scored 5 that day. There was a couple of times he scored 4. Casey, you mentioned the Spurs game where two of them were penalties. He missed a penalty in the middle of it all as well. And I mean, to have the stones to come back up and take another penalty after having missed one is, I mean, fine. You know, you crack on and do that, son.
Well, that game was the most like a game of ping pong I've ever seen a Premier League game.
Despite being 4-1 as well, I know.
There was no sort of midfield by any team in that game. It was literally just counter-attack, and balls bouncing off knees and landing here, there and everywhere. It was a very strange game to watch.
Yeah, so there's three of the times that the player's gone on to score a fourth or and indeed a fifth has been Aguero. City have done that 6 times in total. I think the classic, Dom, is Dzeko at Spurs.
Oh yeah, glorious. I mean, his fourth goal that game is a proper cherry on the icing on the cake goal. And it's also, I mean, the other one being his header at Goodison Park in the Pellegrini title year. But that's the other one of like the absolutely great Dzeko headers of like how has he even got to that? His header in that game is superb. That was a magic day. That was like. I think that was the first time. Admittedly, it was only like the third game of the season. I think. I remember that being the first time thinking, "Blimey, City could win the league this year."
I wasn't ready for that early.
No, but it,
yeah, was I it, definitely, I definitely wasn't, especially because after didn't United beat Arsenal 8-2 on the same day?
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember if we went first or not. I think we might have gone first that day.
Yeah,
well.
We did. Yeah, I remember Nasri being superb in that game for Dzeko. Like just obviously the whole performance was brilliant, but yeah, you're right, Dom. That fourth goal was an absolute peach, wasn't it?
Great kit as well. It's probably the game that makes me think of that really good red and black stripe kit.
Yeah, we'll come back to perfect hat tricks a bit later on, but Dom, Dzeko's first 3 goals in this game made up a perfect hat trick. Does he then ruin it by adding a fourth?
Not when the fourth's that good, no. I remember the pub I watched it in, there was a fella in there who was a Tottenham fan who'd been quiet all the way through. When that fifth goal went in, he was ahead of his time, this guy, in many respects. He started standing up and shouting about money and ruining football and lots of effing and blinding and stormed out, so that was good.
Yeah, if he'd have got a 1-1-5 in there, he'd have been somehow a time traveller from the future, wouldn't he?
Yeah. Off outside to his TARDIS, wasn't he?
Yeah. other times when players have scored additional goals on top of the hat trick, again, Spurs against Sergio Aguero, Newcastle, as we said. Aguero against Leicester was one. And, I mean, Watford take a bit of a battering as well from City most days. Gabriel Jesus did it in 21-22. Kevin De Bruyne at Molineux, Dan. Three left-footed goals to start with as well.
Yeah. That was a cracking performance. That was the day we not signed Haaland, but the club like announced it, wasn't it? I seem to remember that they'd reached an agreement, and De Bruyne did the Haaland celebration after one of his goals, and then said that he wasn't doing that, but you clearly were, Kevin. We all saw it. and that was like, you know, going into the running in that title race. What was it, 3 or 4 games from the end of the season, I think, something like that. And the pressure was really on, and probably one of those games that from the outside, you know, people looking at City go, oh, they just always win these games that easily. But I remember being really, really nervous going into that game. And De Bruyne settled the nerves nicely with his first goal. Then Wolves equalised, and you're thinking, oh, here we go. And then he was just on fire that night. He was just unplayable, like one of those games that he has. It's very rare that you'll see a midfielder score 4 goals in a game, but Kevin De Bruyne can do it.
Yeah. Was that the Paisley kit as well? The one Sam Lee described to me as a Ted Baker shirt your dad had wear.
I like that one.
I mean,
it was all right. Yeah.
I'm not knocking it. It's a nice shirt.
Was it the Paisley kit? Because I remember they wore that at Wolves away early in the, you know, when they played them first game of the season.
Oh, it might not have been. Doors.
Oh no! I'll tell you what it was. It was the, it was like the just let's solve water kit sort of thing. Like it was either
the
all
white with the blue shorts, turquoisey shorts. Yeah,
occasionally wore turquoise shorts.
It was that one.
I thought that was a good kit, all white with turquoise shorts. It just looked like a Liverpool away kit.
Do you think so? What they were going for. Just reminded me a bit of toothpaste.
Yeah, which also probably isn't fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they did wear white shorts in this game, though. So.
Yeah, that's why I would have thought it's the Paisley kit. A lot of Tottenham's away kits look like toothpaste lately, which is weird. Anyway.
Yeah. On to perfect hat tricks then, because there's 4 that City have scored in the Premier League. Dzeko at Spurs in 2011, we've covered. Aguero against Newcastle in 2018. So that's not the one where he scored 5. He liked Newcastle as an opponent anyway. And he got a perfect hat trick in 2018. Sterling at Norwich in 2022. And then Haaland against Forest in 2022. That was his second hat trick in the space of 4 days or something like that. Any of them particularly stand out for you, Dom?
I'm quite fond of the Sterling one, mainly because that was kind of, because that's the year after Sterling and Pep had their fallout, and it was like that little middle of that 21-22 season felt like kind of almost like his little encore at City. Like, we got a little bit of a bonus of Sterling being on good form one last time. I like that hat-trick because he only gets the perfect hat-trick because he takes a trademark dog shit penalty that gets pushed back to him from the tap-in with his left foot.
Why was he ever allowed to take any penalties?
I mean, the man's belief in his penalty taking is something to behold. Because
did you see the one he scored in the shootout against Chelsea, though?
That's what I was going to say. That is his only good penalty for us.
Yeah, arguably the best penalty I've ever seen until Nunes against United in the Community Shield. but yeah, all his other penalties were like, and he took so many bad penalties. Like, do you remember the shootout at Leicester when he put a Panenka over?
I'd forgotten about that. The one I think of is the Wolves one.
Wolves, yeah.
I'm doing it myself now. It's become quite trendy to dunk on Sterling a little bit, but he was such a massive player in that era, and I just enjoyed that little period where he was knocking goals in, missing penalties.
He scored a hat-trick against Bournemouth, Sterling, and I remember coming out of the game after that, and I thought, we've got a Ballon d'Or winner on our hands here. Which obviously proved to be completely wrong, but I just remember thinking in that game, he's just got all the potential in the world.
Yeah, that was City. So to give you a sense of perspective, Casey, that one against Bournemouth was City's 15th Premier League hat trick, and that was in 2015. So in the 9 years that followed that, between Aguero, Haaland, and a couple of others, adding a few elsewhere, they've just smashed the Premier League record.
How can anyone else compete?
we'll have 115 hat tricks by the end of the season.
That Haaland Forest one is a mad one as well. So I was working at that game, but I'd been for the Palace game. I was sat in the stand with my family, and like that had been enjoyable watching him get his first hat trick. But I just remember that when he got his first goal that night, and this is the weird thing. This is the thing I think that sets Haaland apart. As soon as he'd got the one, you were thinking he's going to get another hat trick. Mm. It was like almost all right. He scored pretty early.
Well, it was the Palace one. He scored three in the second half, and then the Forest one, he scored three in the first half, didn't he? Which just goes to show that he could genuinely score six across 90 minutes.
Yeah, I think he probably will do it at some point, won't he? But yeah,
he could have easily. I know we're talking about Premier League hat tricks, but he's done it. He's got five in the Champions League, hasn't he? And he's got five at Luton.
Yeah,
yeah,
it is on. It is on.
Yeah, wasn't it the first time he sort of came to public attention was he scored like nine against Honduras for Norway in like the under 20 World Cup or something. And I think I saw a quote from him recently where he was like annoyed he didn't get 10 in the game because like, when are you ever going to score 10? It's like, yeah, so some people are wired differently. that was the first, and that was the first time I really noticed that Forest game of like just the whole feeling in the ground when he gets one. It's like, I think the goals just feel different when Haaland scores. It really hits different in the ground. And I think part of it is, it's not just the celebration of the goal. It's almost like an anticipation and a giddiness of like, this could get nuts now. Yeah. And very often it does.
Yeah. Dan, what in your mind's eye, what's the perfect, not kind of left foot, right foot header, but what's the perfect Erling Haaland hat trick? Because what I see is a penalty at probably some point in the first half. A second one in the first half on about maybe 30, 35 minutes. And then he rounds off the day on about 70, 75 and just adds his third at that point.
Are you asking what my most satisfying hat-trick is or what like the sort of
what the formula for an Erling Haaland hat-trick probably is?
Because I don't like penalties in a hat-trick. I think it's bollocks actually that they get included almost.
I mean, that's a take. It's still a goal, isn't it?
I can get not liking them in it, but going so far as to say that the bollocks to be included is a bit of a nonsense.
Well, I mean, how are we defining a perfect hat trick as well, actually? Because isn't it supposed to be three goals in succession?
I mean, unbroken.
No,
yeah.
No, that's in Germany, isn't it?
I know
that's what I mean. That's where you're getting that from. It's left foot, right foot, header, isn't it?
Yeah, I think perfect hat trick is left foot, right foot, header. But then again, if you have left foot, right foot, header with no other goals in between, there needs to be a level above perfect then, doesn't there?
Mm.
Platinum hat trick.
Impeccable hat trick.
Yeah, impeccable.
But I'm sure I read something that in Germany a perfect hat trick is three goals in succession in the same half or something.
Oh, now we're getting down to brass tacks, aren't we?
So that Forest one was a perfect hat-trick then?
Yeah, it will have been.
And the Palace one?
Yeah, because he didn't get the first, did he? He got goals 2, 3, and 4. Yeah.
There's a really good goal in that Palace one where basically he ends up on the end of a rondo to score. Like it was like John Stones in the box, and they do a load of passes around the Palace 6-yard box, and he duffs it in. Which I imagine is what Haaland does a lot in the rondos. Like stop with him because he like boots it somewhere, but have to go in the net.
It's such a weird finish that one as well. He sort of scuffed it, didn't he? Like.
Yeah.
Dan, unsurprisingly, City's record most number of hat-tricks in a season is Haaland's first season. They got 5 as a club. He got 4 of them. Foden got 1. Obviously, Foden's hat-trick came in the same game that Haaland also got a hat-trick. What are your memories of that kind of first season of Haaland arriving and kind of the feeling, as Dom says, the anticipation of the fact that, hang on, he's going to do it again here?
Yeah, well, I remember that game in particular being against United, wasn't it? And it was that was great. See, that was a very satisfying hat trick because there was no penalty nonsense in there. very good finishes, like that one where he smashes in at the back post when De Bruyne picks him out with the pass was brilliant. A little bit dissatisfying that one of his goals was like almost cleared off the line, and you know the referee had to consult his watch.
Surely that's more satisfying.
Is it? I don't know. It sort of takes the wind out of a goal celebration a tiny bit, don't you think?
Like, well, that kind of compares to what I was saying about the Aguero one, where they thought they'd scrambled it off the line at Watford, but then they hadn't.
Well, yeah. So with that, I don't know whether it is, like, from where we are in 119, I think we could tell it was in. So I think maybe that we knew it was going to... Well, obviously, you're never 100% sure, but it really, really looked in from the angle that I'm at. So I was confident it was in before the referee actually, had the vibration on his watch thing or whatever they do. Yeah. So yeah, that didn't take anything away from me.
Yeah. But that aside, yeah, that was a amazing win. I mean, apart from United getting the 3 goals, that was kind of annoying, wasn't it? Like,
But I preferred Foden's hat trick in that game anyway.
Yeah, but you are a natural contrarian, aren't you? So that's
no. what wanting like a homegrown local lad to get a hat trick in a derby, and that's contrarian now.
I also love Foden's hat trick goal in that you think surely that must be offside because all the United players just ran to Haaland like, oh no, the best kid in the playground's got the ball again, just left Phil Foden unmarked. Yeah, that was weird. I mean, it's a bit of a bittersweet one for me because I got COVID and I couldn't go to that game. And like watching the goals rack up at home, thinking. Yeah, 2 hat tricks in the Manchester derby. That's probably never happening again on planet Earth. Good.
Yeah, I want to finish with some other players that we haven't given any credit to yet so far. Carlos Tevez got a fair chunk of City hat tricks. Casey, any standout for you? The one I always think of is when he did the golf swing at Carrow Road.
Yeah, the golf swing at Carrow Road's a great one, but for me, it's against Blackburn. I thought that was a great hat trick, and we really needed that win at the time, and he pretty much won that game on his own.
Was that early Mancini days?
I think so, yeah. And that seemed to be, because do you remember, like, Tevez didn't start, like, Adebayor started better than Tevez initially, and then Adebayor obviously got suspended, and I think that Blackburn game was just the start of Tevez lifting off kind of thing, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it was actually City's first hat-trick under Mancini, I've just checked. It was only the 4th in the Premier League after Wanchope and Elka and Rubinho before that.
I'm fond of the Rubinho one as well at Stoke.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a good day. We had Daniel Sturridge set up one of those goals, which is just goes to show you how long ago that one was.
Yeah.
But yeah, that Tevez one against Blackburn, he pretty much won the game on his own, and from then on he seemed to have the bit between his teeth and just sort of drag us through then for a full season.
Yeah.
Fond memories.
Dom, we have to give Bernardo his credit against Watford because Bernardo's probably not... He's one of those players that probably isn't going to score many hat-tricks in his career. It might even be his only one. And then you get Watford come to town, City stick 8 past them, and then Bernardo's surprising you by getting 3 of them.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the thing I always remember about that one is his social media cartoon he put out afterwards to cause a load of hassle. So if next time he scores a hat-trick, he could like refrain from doing racially insensitive things, that'd be top. but it is always good when players who wouldn't normally be on these lists like pop up on them. Just looking down your list, I do feel for Riyad Mahrez in that he got his hat-trick behind closed doors at home to Burnley. It's like, could you put together a more forgettable set of circumstances for taking on the match ball? I mean,
well,
Eli...
the mad one is that one of his goals was a header. When have you ever seen Riyad Mahrez head the ball at all?
I know.
Like, never mind score from one.
Yeah. Dan's going to tell us that Yaya Toure's only hat trick doesn't count because two of them were penalties.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm sorry, rules are rules. Yeah.
Oh, but the third one is an absolute boom goggler, though, isn't it? Like 30-yard top bins.
Boom goggler?
A boom goggler?
That's a new one for the lexicon.
Boom goggler, yeah. That's just smacking the ball.
You've just started, like, a 400-message WhatsApp group chat there with that one. Jesus.
Oh, God, yeah. get Susie Dent on the line.
Well, what are your thoughts on the Balotelli one against Villa then, Dan?
I'm having trouble remembering that one, to be quite honest with you.
So from memory, he scores from less than a yard and two penalties, or it's one penalty and two goals from less than a yard. Because, like,
I mean, he was good at penalties, wasn't he? So was Yaya, to be fair.
I reckon.
Yeah. So they count now if you're good at penalties. What are the rules then?
Balotelli's penalties count because they're cool as fuck.
Yeah, there we go. That's the rule.
Right, you got to
be cool. Take a cool penalty, then yeah.
I see. Okay, well, how about then? Let's finish with. I think this game was behind closed doors, Dom, but I might be misremembering. But a player that completely shocked me when I was putting this list together that I'd completely forgotten about. But one of the goals is an absolute peach. Ferran Torres at Newcastle in the maddest game you've ever seen.
It's brilliant.
Scott Carson played in, didn't he?
Yeah.
That back heel's incredible, isn't it?
I think that ended up getting City's goal of the season, didn't it? And He hit a nice little run of form towards the end of that season. And I remember after that hat-trick, there was kind of a little bit of, because there were maybe 9 or 10 of the starting lineup places were sorted for the Champions League final. I thought, maybe Ferran Torres has played his way into the lineup. But obviously the manager had a bigger surprise up his sleeve that day. So yeah, because the home game, so the game after when they were away at Brighton and Cancelo got sent off, I always think this is a funny commentator's word, a bit Old Testament, but Torres got sacrificed, didn't he, because of that 10 men. and that probably ended his Champions League final hopes. I definitely remember Torres starting was one of the scenarios I guessed when Sam Lee come into the ground and went, have you seen the team, with like a face that suggested bad things had gone on. And I had a few guesses and I didn't get anywhere near what Guardiola had done that night. But that was really good. That's the thing with Torres. It's kind of a shame he went to Barcelona.
It's a what might have been, isn't it?
He started the next season pretty well as well, didn't he? Like, did he score against Norwich and Arsenal? And I thought, he's really coming into his own now. And then he left and he's just been crap since, really.
Yeah, he's been terrible for them, hasn't he? I think he would have been a good player if he'd stayed.
Yeah, I look at him and think, oh, he's been a bit crap. But then you think, well, he'd have been getting coached by Guardiola every day, which tends to steer people well.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Listen to it. Drink it in.
That was a look at City's hat-tricks in the Premier League. We're going to finish with some listener questions. Get in touch for future shows at Blue Moon Podcast on Twitter. You can email through the website as well. Just go to bluemoonpodcast.com, fill in the form there. If you're sending us a tweet, why not go a step further and send us a DM with a voice note, because it means we can play it out in this bit. And I'm quite keen to do that over the next few shows. So get in touch on Twitter as well with a voice note. David's been in touch on Twitter to say, there's some outrage online about the prices for the Inter Milan game. It might be worth including a comparison with Premier League games for context. I've not checked this, as you need to log in and try and buy a ticket to find the prices, and there's no Category A tickets currently available. But I think the Inter game is slightly cheaper than a Category A Premier League game. From memory, they were around £70-ish this season. Neither prices are right, but as I've said before, City will use Premier League ticket prices as a guide for the Champions League prices for the big games. It seems nobody pays attention to tickets for individual games until something like this happens, despite the same, if not worse, issues with the Premier League tickets. Now, Chris, we've talked about ticket prices endlessly on the show. You know, you've been on multiple episodes where we've had this ticket price discussion. That hasn't changed again. The position is the same sort of, the club has probably priced it too high. what do you make of the kind of furore around the Inter tickets? Because if you're on the cup scheme, your season ticket holder or a member with the cup scheme, it's between $37.50 and $67.50 for a ticket for an adult. If you're not on the cup scheme, that becomes $42.50 to $72.50. And as David says, as for Category A Premier League games, I can't find it either. There's no there's none available to currently get and try and check out. So we can't do a direct comparison, but it is in that ballpark. What do you make of it all?
Well, you'd probably not be hugely surprised to hear that. I think it's a bit snide, and it's not just like, it's like the boiling frogs analogy, isn't it? I think where it's incremental. People are expected to put up with this, but I think a lot of the outrage is linked to the Oasis debacle, where people have seen a lot of rip-offs happening there, and then these get announced on the, you know, very shortly after, and people are just like, oh come on, everyone's getting ripped off everywhere, and then you get people saying, hey, calm down, it's only the same as a big game in the Premier League. And the equivalent is the group games in the previous format, so it's understandable that people are going to be annoyed. Even if it is a big team, it's still just the first foray into the competition, isn't it? Mm.
There used to be a deal as well, didn't there? You used to be able to buy the three group games for a combined price that would be cheaper than buying them individually, and that doesn't seem to be on offer this time.
No, they're constantly looking for ways to maximise revenue, and there's never any real consideration given to the fact that people are facing high costs everywhere else, and you know, you don't really need to do this to us, so please stop doing it. It's just kind of morally and ethically wrong.
I suppose the other problem here, Rob, is that this is only the Inter game, so we don't know what the other games in the Champions League will be priced at. But there is an extra game in the Champions League this time around as well, so there's an extra opportunity for them to fill the stadium and get more money in anyway.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I haven't gone to Champions League games for about 6 years. The last one I went to was the 2-1 defeat to Liverpool in 2018. Pretty much for this reason, actually, because the added expense was something that it put us off, really. We used to go as a family, and if you go in with two or even three people, it suddenly becomes a, you know, three-figure sum, and you'd rather use that with other things like, you know, life stuff, bills, etc. But I think with ticket pricing like this, I think there's clearly demographics they're going for that we're not part of, and they want those demographics at Champions League games. I think, you know, they know that the regulars and the season ticket holders and the kind of like, you know, the sort of 40 to 45,000 sort of like City regulars will always come to like league games on season tickets and things like that. But Champions League games, because they're midweek, because they're a little bit harder to get to because of work and things like that, I think they clearly see some kind of market opportunity that we're clearly not aware of. And I find it all very cynical and depressing.
I mean, the flip side
like is we have this debate every year, but
yeah. But I mean, the flip side there though is that the club could quite easily turn around and say, well, the stadium's full, so it seems it's been priced correctly.
Yeah, because unfortunately, I think that, you know, it's football. We're all addicted to it and we love it. And so we'll find a way, you know, enough people will find a way to make sure that they're there for the, you know, for the live experience and stuff. And so from a, you know, from a balance sheet point of view or a revenue point of view, the heads upstairs will be saying like, oh, you know, well, you know, our decision's justified, you know, people keep paying it and what's good for the club is what's good for the fans, right? But it feels like we have this discussion every single year. They do token things like doing meetings and stuff where they kind of nod and kind of stroke their chins a bit and then just kind of go through with what they were going to do anyway.
That's it, isn't it? It might be full, but it's full of people who can afford it, and that's pricing out a lot of people who can't. If it was made more affordable, then you'd get a more realistic cross-section of our fans being able to go, rather than simply pricing a lot of them out, which is the issue.
Yeah. While we're talking about tickets, I just want to revisit something that we touched on earlier in the season as well, disabled parking at the Etihad. On the first show this season, we heard from Howard Cohen, who is the chair of the Disabled Supporters Association. He explained why he wasn't happy that City had suddenly imposed a car parking charge on blue badge holders.
Disabled fans are, as a group, probably on average the fans with the lowest incomes, given how many are living on benefits and also how many are elderly as well. It's probably the one specific group of fans who make the most financial sacrifices already to attend games. And a lot will have made significant sacrifices to get their season tickets in the first place, or to pay for match tickets for the matches they can attend. Blue badge holders have their blue badges for a reason, and that is the fact that they're not able to walk a significant distance from their cars to the stadium. And in many cases, they're not able to use public transport, or the public transport isn't available to them because of their disabilities. Those who are not disabled do have a choice. They can use public transport. They can use other means of getting to the match. They can park further away and walk a bit further. They do have other options. With disabled fans, parking further away for many is just not an option.
That's Howard Cohen. The full interview is in the first episode of the season if you scroll back on our feed. The 1894 group, the Fan Advisory Board City Matters, the Official Supporters Club, MCFC Fans Food Bank Support, the Solid Citizens Fan Group and many individual fans have all got together to try and help the Disabled Supporters Association fundraise for Blue Badge holders to cover some of the costs of their car parking at City. There's a GoFundMe page set up. If you're in a position to donate, you can find the details of that on 1894 group's social media. They've got it as their top tweet at the moment. So if you're going to have a look on their Twitter, we are 1894. You can find it there. It's estimated it'll cost just over £2,000 for disabled fans to park just for the Brentford game coming up. At the time of recording, and that's just over 24 hours after the GoFundMe was launched, thanks to the generosity of City fans, there's more than £1,400 in there already. That's just for one game too. So this is not an issue that will be going away anytime soon. We're going to finish this week with Steve on the emails, who set us a load of top threes to work out. This is kind of a Patreon episode that we do, but we're going to dive into it for this one. He said, in order, what are your top three? And then give us a load of categories. So we're going to start with the best signings during Guardiola's reign. Rob, what do you reckon?
First up, Edison. Mm-hmm. I think he completely revolutionised the way that City were allowed to play and the way that Pep wanted us to play. Second up, I'm trying to do these in order, but Rodri, I think that, again, he's another signing who, in the sort of the second era of Pep's team, allowed us to play the way that Pep wanted us to play once Fernandinho was beginning to kind of, you know, because obviously Fernandinho was like the backbone of the Centurions and domestic treble seasons. But then after that, form started to suffer a little bit and he was moved around the team a lot. And I think, you know, Rodri coming in and kind of making that position his own, I think has pushed us to a level where we were capable of being able to win the Champions League, for example.
Yep.
And third up is probably Ruben Dias, I think, because when he signed, we were in a bit of a tight spot in terms of the defenders that we had available, because obviously Nathan Ake spent a lot of that season injured, and we had Eric Garcia starting quite a lot of games. And I think that Dias coming in just kind of, it was just needed at that exact necessary point, just as someone, and obviously managing to get a good deal, obviously with Otamendi being part of it as well, and making a good kind of transition and a good change there, which again, pushed us to the level where we were capable of doing like a Champions League and four in a row. He's never gone into a Premier League season and not won the title. I think that's right. Then do that 4 years running as well. There's other ones I could have listed. There's absolutely loads, but I think those are the three that kind of stand out as like particular milestones in Pep's time.
Go along with that, Chris, or any room for the likes of Haaland or Gundogan?
Well, I would say, Gundogan was the first, and I think one of the most important, so I definitely have him in the top three, because he kind of set the tone in terms of this is the sort of player I want, this is the way we're going to play. This guy, I mean, he had that much. He put that much stock in him. He signed him while he was injured, and he's been, you know, apart from that brief dalliance with those dodgy, shirky skint Catalans, he's been an absolute mainstay. So he's been really important. Edison, I would agree with. He's changed our style of play so much that you don't really need to be good at one-on-ones, which is ideal.
Mm.
I would also say Rodri, because he's just the absolute linchpin, the metronome, the tone setter, and kind of the boss on the pitch that instills all the values that, that Guardiola wants amongst the players when they're actually out there.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, over to you, Chris. The worst signings during Guardiola's reign. Let's let's just run through the names on this one. I think we all understand why. If you were to pick them out,
I mean, Nolito was a bit of a miss.
Yeah,
he did all right, and then decided he didn't really fancy it. Bravo.
I thought Bravo would be the first name to the lips, to be honest. But there we are.
Well, there's two trains of thought on that, isn't it? I mean, he did actually pulls out of the shit in a couple of penalty shootouts. Although, yeah, I would say the minuses definitely outweigh the pluses. And I hate to say it because he's a lovely lad, etc., etc. But lovely poor old Calvin.
Yeah,
has to be in there.
So Nolito wasn't in the ones I was thinking about, Rob. I was going to chuck in Angelino, who came back in 2019. But apart from that, I think I'm pretty much on board with what Chris has said.
I have exactly the same three players. Yeah. Bravo, Phillips, Nolito. Like, they are all there. But I will say that how hard that was to pick three names that I was completely unsatisfied with shows, like, how high... Because, like, even players that maybe didn't contribute absolutely loads, like, they still have, like, maybe a Premier League title to their name or a League Cup to their name or something like that. So I had to kind of pick players where, like, maybe, you know, like, Nolito, no trophies to his name. It seems that Pep soured on him pretty fast. He hated Manchester. He seemed to have, like, a really short fuse that probably could have had him sent off in a few occasions. Well, he was sent off, wasn't he? We were 4-0 up against Bournemouth and he just headbutted somebody.
He kept headbutting people. Yeah, yeah. Can you stop doing that, please, mate? Please don't headbutt people.
Also, one of the most annoying names to hear Steve McManaman pronounce. Nolito! Very, very annoying.
Yeah, I forgot that every now and then we get a Steve McManaman impression from Higgy. Let's finish with...
Also sounds like a shit cocktail.
Yeah, let's finish with... Steve also asked us for best and worst signings since the takeover in 2008, but I'm going to gloss over that because I'm interested in the best academy graduates of all time at City. So, Rob, given the variation in ages on the podcast, I'm going to start with you. What are you going to have?
Cheek.
Can I go back a little bit and just say that there's a place in hell reserved for Tal Ben Haim and how I felt watching him play?
Yeah, all right. Yeah.
But yeah, for my favourite academy product of all time, there is a part of my heart that forever lives with the number 29 for Sean Wright Phillips. He made it worth it as a kid, I think, going as a season ticket holder every single week during those periods. And I cried a little bit. Actually a lot when he left, and then I did a full lap of a campsite in Wales when it came through on the radio that we got him back. I was 14, I think, when we signed him back, and I did a full lap shouting that we'd brought him home. But obviously statistically Foden in it.
How big was the campsite?
Pretty big. Yeah pretty big. I forget the name of it, but it was, you know, pretty sizable field. But I guess, you know, stamina of a 14-year-old, you can just run and then not think about it.
Yeah. Chris, top three academy graduates for you?
It's tough to pick three, really. Bit before my time, but I think Neil Young deserves a shout. He came through the ranks from Fallowfield, didn't he? He's got a few big goals. But yeah, Sean Wright Phillips was up there for me. It's hard to not mention Foden. And from my youth, we've got players like David White and Paul Lake, which is one of the things I was going to bring back from the 90s, actually, David White being fast. But yeah, I've given you four or five there, so sorry about that. Never my strong point.
I'll let Steve decide on which ones he's going to take as his correct answers. But there we are. We are running out of time for this week's show. So that's it for the Blue Moon podcast for this week. Thank you very much for listening. And thanks also to my guests for this one. Chris Higginbottom.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And Rob Wilson.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you for having me.
There's a clip of this week's Nostalgia Show coming up. Guy Burke has been telling me about all the games that shaped him as a supporter, so go and check that out. We've got the brand new podcast merch shop as well that I definitely don't feel awkward about advertising, but if you want a mug or a print or a hoodie or a t-shirt or something like that with an exclusive City design, head on over to our Twitter and see our pinned tweet. I'll be back next week to preview the games with Brentford and Inter Milan. See you then.
That was the Blue Moon podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, You can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
The Colin Bell goal, where he equalises to make it 2-2, I can still see that vision in my head now. Again, on the wall at the Kippax, and I could literally see Colin Bell going through his Stepney. What's he going to do? He's going to shoot. He's going to lob it over him. Cool as you like, just takes it round him, slides it in. I think even talking to you now about it, the hairs on the back of my neck, you know, 53 years later or whatever. It was also a pivotal season, of course. City probably should have won the league. They were sort of pretty much home and hosed with about 8 games to go. Malcolm Allison, who was entitled team manager then, I think, of course, signed Rodney Marsh, which he'd been trying to do for at least 2 years. But Joe Mercer had his hands firmly on the old purse strings and said, no way, we're paying big money for him. He's a bit of a show-off and all this sort of thing. You know, he wasn't a Joe Mercer type player at all. But of course, when Alisson got into the hot seat, he was one of the first players he signed. There's a very strong sort of school of thought that he cost City the league, which I don't entirely buy, because I think it's a quite an easy cop-out for a lot of players who probably underperformed.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast. And join us again next time for another episode.